Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So yesterday we were talking about the identities of these three Purushas. How the adhyatmic person, the jiva, and the adhidaivic person, the demigods and the sensory functions, when the living entity is disembodied, then even though both are present, but you cannot really, particularly in functional terms, you cannot see them as distinct entities. The jiva is there, and of course, as stated here in 59.2, the jiva feels himself to be a conscious, independent entity and capable of illuminating his senses. He feels like that. But of course, at that time he's disembodied, so he can't show it. And the demigods, who are controlling the functions of the senses, they also feel like that. I mean, yeah, they feel at least that we are the ones who really make these sensory functions happen. But there's no body. There's no adibhautik person. So therefore none of them can show themselves for what they are. So like that, they're indistinguishable, functionally. Functionally, they're indistinguishable without a body to actually start doing things and showing what they can do. Of course, similarly, when both are disembodied, then they're equal as jivas too. Isn't it? When the conditioned soul who is to be controlled by the demigods and so on is disembodied, then and the demigod is disembodied, then even though, you know, in terms of their karma, how they're actually going to be situated when they get their bodies, even though they're going to be very different, and that's already sort of written in the stars, you know, it's in their karma like that. But still you can't see it while both are disembodied. So they're equal as jivas too. They're jivas. And one, you know, they're the same in that sense. And you couldn't distinguish that this is now going to be the controlled and this is going to be the controller, until they get their bodies and start functioning in those terms. So both in terms, in functional terms, in relation to the conditioned soul who hasn't got a body yet, and just in relation to each other existentially as living entities, when both are disembodied, when there's no adibhautik person there, then in both senses they can be taken as being the same. I mean, they are effectively, actually, they are the same. But only when the bodies come along, when the jiva gets his body, then the fact that the demigods are required, actually, for the sensory capabilities to all function and work and manifest, that becomes apparent. In that, even though the jiva has a body, but if the demigod is not giving the power, like in the case of a blind person, even though the body is there, now the jiva has his body and the jiva may feel, yes, you know, I have consciousness and so on, I can do these things. And he's got the eyeball. But unless the demigod helps, then still, the jiva cannot do that. cannot actually see. Therefore you have blind people. Jivas in bodies with eyeballs, but without the help of the demigods, so they're not seeing. So then, at that point, in terms of function with the individual conditioned soul, then you can see that this is the jiva with his capabilities, and here this is the adidaivic person. These are the demigods. These are the sensory functions working separately from the jiva and helping the jiva. That's how it's expressed in the verse. The deities who help them. Even though the jivas consider themselves independent actors and they consider themselves the illuminators of their senses, actually they need the deities to help them. And when the body is there and those functions by the help of the demigods can actually go on, then you can see, here the adidaivic person's acting, and this is now the jiva who's giving the body life, but not able independently to provide his own sense of ability to see exactly. So the distinction between the two in functional terms in regard to the individual living entity, the distinction only becomes apparent when there's a body. And in terms of the two of them, as the controller on one hand and the controlled on the other, with those capacities, that only becomes apparent when both have bodies. Otherwise, when they both don't have bodies, even though one is going to be the controller and the other is going to be the controlled, but you can't see that. So they are the same. I don't know if that makes it perhaps slightly clearer at least than yesterday I was going through it. Anyway, I think it makes it a little clearer. So let us now go on to text 60, and this is exploring the whole subject of how they're interdependent and, you know, they have certain capacities to some degrees, but... You know, so therefore it's arguable that some or maybe even all of them could be called Ashrayas in certain circumstances, but only those circumstances and not generally. But in order for someone to actually qualify to be the Ashraya, as described in these two verses, then that person has to actually be completely independently the Ashraya, at not relying on anybody else in any way. Then, and giving shelter to everybody else, then in terms of these two verses, or actually particularly the last verse, verse 9, then you could say, this is the Ashraya, this is really the Ashraya, as described here, not just some limited Ashraya in certain circumstances, but not in others. So this is what we're going to be reading about. Let's go through then. Text 60.1. So now this is discussing the last verse, 2.10.9. Let's just read the translation. It's on page 80. So the two verses, the translations are there together, but actually the translation of the second verse is the last sentence. He who knows... Oh, wait a minute. No. In the absence of any one of these, we do not perceive the other two. He who knows these three is the Lord, who, being independent of everything else, is the support of his own self and is the true Ashraya in the complete meaning of the term, not just a partial meaning. So in the absence of any one of these, we do not perceive the other two. And he who knows all of them, and who's independent completely of all of them and anything else that may exist, and is the sport of everything, including himself, that is really the Ashraya. This is who we're looking for. So 60.1. The verse beginning, Ekam Eka Taraba Ve 2:10:9, shows how the fact that all of these three Purushas are mutually dependent, in effect, means that none of them is the Ashraya, or that Ashraya, the real, ultimate Ashraya. The explanation is as follows. Without the presence of the visible object, there is no basis for the existence of either the sense organ, whose presence is inferred from perception of the object, or the seer. So, without the presence, which is inferred by its perception, without the presence of the visible object, there's no basis for the existence of either the sense organ. So what is that referring to, the sense organ? Adibhotic. Adibhotic, the organ. The organ. So, without the presence of the visible object means the sense, the actual perceptive sense. Then, there's no basis for the existence of either the organ, the adibhotic, or the seer, the adiatmic, the jiva. And without the seer, the sun god and other presiding deities of perception also have no basis for existing. Without a jiva to use the power of seeing, those controlling deities of the power of seeing, they become unemployed, actually, isn't it? It's just like if you have a manager, he's a manager, big manager, managing here and there and this way and that. Then suddenly, everyone who he's managing, they all disappear, they're gone, they're just not there. So what sort of manager is he now? He's not a manager. He may have been a manager, but he's not actually a manager now. You know, he may be an entity, but he's not a manager now, because there's no one for him to manage. So like this, without the jiva to utilize the power of seeing, then the demigods become at best useless. You know, ineffectual or effectively non-existent. They just kind of cease. In those terms, they cease as providers of sensory ability. If there's no one to use the ability, they are not providers of sensory ability. Got it? Without the seer, the sun god and other presiding deities of perception also have no basis for existing. Without the presiding deity of sight, the sense of sight cannot act, meaning the organ cannot act if that sensory capacity is not available. The organ cannot act, the adibhotic cannot act. And without the sense of sight, there can be no perception. If there's no eye, ball, you know, the actual organ, then how's the sense of sight going to act and see? It's not. It's not just going to see anyway. It needs the eyeball to see. So therefore, without the sense of sight, which in this context means the eyeball, then there's no actual seeing being done. In other words, the deities are now dysfunctional, non-functional. Thus, in the absence of any one of the three Purushas, we cannot find either of the others. So just consider, you've got the body, the jiva, or say the jiva, the body, and the demigod. If there's no jiva to take a body and animate the body, then the body's useless, and the deity that presides or provides the sensory capabilities of the body is useless. If there's no jiva, if there's no body, the jiva is useless, because the conditioned soul needs a body. It cannot really function without a body. So without a body, the jiva becomes useless, and obviously the sensory capacity becomes useless, because there's no body to manifest in and act through. And without the sensory capabilities, the jiva, even if he has a body, the jiva's useless and the body's useless. So therefore he says there's no basis for existence of any of them in the absence of any one. Does that sound okay? Does it really sound okay? Okay. All right. I mean, it's fairly simple, really. Okay, so thus in the absence of any one, we cannot find either of the others. Such being the case, the one who knows all three of these, perceiving them visually as their witness, namely the Supersoul, is indeed the actual ashraya, or shelter. In refutation of the idea that the three purushas are shelters for one another, the Supersoul is specifically characterized as swashraya, his own shelter. So he's distinguished. You know, you could arguably say that in a limited sense, each of the three is a shelter for the others, because they're so interdependent. But if we're talking about the real ashraya, the real shelter, who is just, you know, independent and does not need anyone or anything else at all, then, the three will not qualify in terms of their giving some shelter to each other, as described here, that in the absence of any one, the other two are lost. So therefore you could say that one is therefore acting as a type of shelter for the other two under those circumstances. But to refute the idea that the three Purushas could be that shelter, that ultimate shelter, then the Supersoul is described as being swashraya. He is actually his own independent shelter, meaning that he has no other shelter and is consequently the shelter of all others. In this context, the living entity can also be called ashraya, but only in the sense of emphasizing the partial non-difference between the pure jiva and the Supersoul, who are related as part and whole, respectively. In other words, you know, you could argue that out of the three, the jiva is the most capable. The jiva is the most capable. You could say that. He is more capable than the others. He's still dependent, but he's more capable. So if you wanted to say that, it would only be in the sense of recognizing that he's a minute part and parcel of that same Supersoul. And he's reflecting that the greatness and the true independence of the supersoul, but only really in a very limited sense. So again, you know, it's just in a limited sense we could say, all right, in this situation, the jiva, we can call him Ashraya. You know, just like a drop of water in the ocean. A drop of water and the ocean. You know, they're one and they're different. They're one. You cannot say that they're just totally different. But then there are differences. You know, if you go swimming in the ocean, you find sharks. If you look in a drop of water, you won't find any sharks. You know, so there's a difference. I don't know if any of you are from surfing backgrounds, but you can surf in the ocean, but you can't surf on a drop of water, or in a drop of water, you can't do it. So there's some oneness there, okay. But as soon as you go a couple of steps down the path of looking at the oneness, then you start seeing that there's some very significant differences. So, you know, let's not get into it too much, that the drop of water in the ocean are one, you know. It's only in a very limited sense. Why would you say that Jiva is the most capable? Because he's eternal. And he's eternally self-existent, actually. The body isn't. And the demigod, as a jiva, of course, the demigod is. But as the controller of sensory functions, he's not eternal. Just while he's in the demigod's body, he's that. But the jiva is always the jiva. So let's go on to 60.2. So now, this is examining further the suggestion that the jiva can be considered an ashraya, and you know, maybe if we really give him a push, maybe he could be considered that ashraya. I mean, you know, let's give it a try. Let's try and argue it a little further. Because Supersoul has been described here in 60.1 as a witness. But the Jiva Goswami says, the pure Jiva is also designated as a witness. So maybe he's the Ashraya. Give him a chance. Maybe he can be elected. The pure Jiva is designated as the witness in such statements as, although transcendental, he considers himself a material product. That is the very first line of the Sanskrit, other than the word iti. Ata paropi manute nartam is from 175. It's one line or so from 175. So then there are other statements, like that whole verse there, that verse is 11, 13, 27. Waking awareness, dream, and deep sleep are the functions of the mind caused by the modes of material nature. The individual soul has been ascertained to be distinct from these functions as their witness. And then it's like the first half of the line of prose is actually part of Srimad Bhagavatam 5.11.12. Iti shudo vajashte yavashudakartu. The pure one witnesses the actions of the impure agent, the mind. So now, okay, he's a witness. But he's not just a witness you know, he's not that independent. Because, like in the first statement, even though he's transcendental, but he considers himself a material product. So he's not just witnessing. He's implicated. And so then waking, awareness, dream, deep sleep are functions of the mind caused by the modes of nature. The individual soul has been ascertained to be distinct from these functions as their witness. You know, but it takes you have to ascertain that. Otherwise, you know, it appears that he's part of it. He thinks he's part of it, isn't it? The conditioned soul. He thinks he's part of it. We may ascertain that he's not, that he is really just a witness, but he thinks he's part of it. He is implicated. So he's not just the witness, like how the super soul is just the witness. And the pure one witnesses the actions of the impure agent, the mind. Well, he not only witnesses, but he gets implicated, isn't it? So therefore he thinks, oh, I'm feeling sad today. Oh, I'm confused today. Oh, I'm happy today. It's the mind, the impure mind. So, you know, he's sort of witnessing. But actually he's identifying. He is identifying. So he's not just the witness, like the super soul, who's simply witnessing. So Jiva Goswami goes on to say that the pure Jiva, being characterized thus, he is implicated. So, because of that, it cannot reasonably be proposed that this jiva, who is known as the witness, sometimes, or in certain respects, you cannot reasonably propose that he is that ashraya, who is purely a witness and totally independent. Then, alternatively, now this, I don't know if this is really expressed so clearly. Alternatively, one might propose that the aspects of adhyatmic and so on are also ashrayas. We answer that this is true. Well, it says satyam, satyam. Yes, maybe. But still, since they're dependent on one another, you know, I went through, I've got a number of translations of this, and what it seems to be saying more is that, because we've already talked about the three of them being ashrayas, but this is more saying that why don't we say that all three of them put together are the ashraya? If you put them all together and say they're one now, then why don't we say that all three of them together are the ashraya? But then, you know, you still get a problem. You know, it may be. In fact, he says, satyam. Satyam. You know, it's true. Or it's sort of, it's like that. You could say that. But still, if you analyze, you see that there's dependency there. And therefore, you can't say that they are, even as one, that they're just totally independent and they're just the ashraya. It's not really like that. It's a mixed situation. It's a mixed situation. So if you say that they're all together the ashraya, still it contradicts 2.10.9 because of the interdependence, and it's just not so clear. It's like a mixed up situation. It's not so clear, like what is stated in the verse, that he who knows these three is the Lord, who, being independent of everything else, is the support of his own self and is the true ashraya. It's not clear enough. It's not straightforward enough There are weaknesses in that argument. There are weaknesses. So 60.2 then concludes that the jiva is not really the ashraya, only in a very limited sense. And even all three of them put together are not really the ashraya. Because, I mean, how could they be the ashraya and then know these three and be the Lord at the same time and be independent of everything else, meaning themselves? Right? Doesn't make good sense. And they're temporary too. Yeah. They lack certain qualifications necessary to really be the ashraya. So, okay, let's go back. Let's go over now to 60.3. Jiva Goswami says, all right, let's just continue on trying to say that the jiva is the ashraya. Because, you know, it's not just a matter of witnessing. He may be a little weak on the witnessing side, but he may have other qualifications. So, in answer to this idea that then let the witness, the jiva, be the shelter, in answer the words beginning tritiyam are spoken. This means, if we look back at the verse 9, it's the last line, which is tritiyam tatriyo veda. He who knows these three is the Lord, who being independent of everything else is the support of his own self and is the true ashraya. So, in answer to this idea that the witness, the jiva, could be the shelter, these words are spoken. So he says, the witnessing self, the jiva, can be called swashraya, his own shelter, to some degree, because he exists. He's existing. He's eternal. And, you know, so there he is. He's existing by his own eternal spiritual potency as an eternal entity. He's like that, eternally. So in a certain sense, he is swashraya. He is giving himself his own shelter. Because he's like that eternally. Whether anybody likes it or not, he's going to be a jiva forever, just because he is. So, in that sense, you could say he's swashraya. But still, if you analyze, you see he is still dependent on the supersoul. So even being his own shelter to some degree, just, you know, as an existent entity, but there's more to it than that. Like, you know, in his condition state, he needs a body. Otherwise, he's kind of useless. In his liberated state, mukti, of being the eternal servant of the Lord, he needs the Lord. So, his being swashraya is just in that very small sense of being an eternal entity. But in terms of his greater ongoing existence as an entity, within the material world, he needs a body, which needs demigods to give the sensory functions. In the liberated state, he needs Krishna. He needs the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Otherwise, he'll be incomplete. I mean, yeah, his existence, his life will be incomplete. So in fact, his ashraya is the supersoul. But the supersoul has no other shelter. He doesn't need anybody. When he appears in the material world, he appears by his own potency, in his own body. And in the spiritual world, he can just exist quite happily. He doesn't need anyone to look after him. He doesn't need anyone like that. So he gives his own shelter. Well, maybe not necessarily, actually. But bear in mind that here we're also talking about Krishna. Yeah. We're also talking about Krishna. But, you know, most particularly we're looking at the conditioned jiva. But also there is, you know, behind the scenes this broader type of focus on Krishna himself. So this is the difference between the two. That the jiva, you know, even in terms of his conditioned existence, how does he get the body? He doesn't get it by his own potency. He gets it by the power of the supersoul. How does he get the help of the demigods? Well, that's neither by his own potency nor just by the potency of the demigods. It's only by the arrangement, the potency of the supersoul. So in those terms, you know, the specific terms of the conditioned jiva, then it's the supersoul. And the supersoul has no other ashraya. Of course, you could say, well, he has Krishna, which is true. But then we're also including Krishna in this, so it's okay. We can still say he has no, the supersoul has no ashraya. So then another example. Similarly, the Hansaguya prayers say, who speaks the Hansaguya prayers? Is that Daksha? Daksha. You know, even though Daksha's a bit of a case sometimes, bit of a character, but it looks like he knows a few things. So he says, a person who knows the modes of nature may know everything about them, but he doesn't know the all-knowing one. I worship that unlimited Lord. In other words, the jiva, he's all right as far as he goes. But he doesn't go that far. He doesn't go all the way. His potency is not, you know, all-encompassing. He is swashraya to some extent. Just like a person who knows the modes of nature, he can say, well, I know everything about them. But that doesn't mean he knows everything about everything. So the jiva may be self-existent. That's all right. But there's more to it than that. There's Krishna, actually. So therefore, Daksha says, I worship him. He's really the one to be worshipped. He's really the ashraya. Thus it is that the supersoul, described in such statements as the one beginning, Abhasascha, is alone the ashraya, that ashraya, the real ashraya, who is as 2:10:9. Well, actually, as 2:10:7 says, the Supreme One, who's celebrated as the Supreme Being or the Supreme Soul, is the supreme source of the cosmic manifestation, as well as its reservoir and winding up. Thus, he is the supreme fountainhead, the absolute truth. He is the ashraya. And as 2:10:9 says, he's independent of everything else. He's the support of his own self. He is the true ashraya. He is really the ashraya. This is the person. That's Krishna. That's the supersoul in terms of adiatmic, adidaivic, and adibhotic. But ultimately it's Krishna himself. Hare Krishna. Oh, we forgot to hand out the attendance sheet. You know, we've got an amazing attendance sheet here. It's one of the longest I've ever seen. But so many people come and go. It's astonishing. Can you mark yourselves present? Any comments or questions? as being, so that they're synonymous. Well, yeah, the thing is that in 2:10:9, it was said that he who knows these three, you know, it implies like he is the witness, he knows them, he sees them. So this witnessing thing is, you know, a capacity, like a feature of the Ashraya, that he knows things, he's witnessing things, he's seeing things, and he's aware of things. So it's in that sense. Yes. That's right. Even when he's not, even when he's in a liberated state, he doesn't witness everything. You know, he witnesses his own sphere, even in the spiritual world. Yeah. So, you know, it's like this last daksha, what daksha says. A person may know the modes of nature. Doesn't mean he knows everything. So we may know our sphere materially or even spiritually, but that doesn't mean that we know everything. So even though the jiva is a witness, you know, the body's not really a witness. The demigods, in the sense of supplying the sensory capabilities, are not really witnesses. It's just a matter of sensory capabilities, that's all. So, but the jiva has this witnessing power, which is one inherent capacity of the Ashraya. Therefore, he was exploring this idea that, you know, because the jiva is a witness, maybe he's that real Ashraya. Yeah? Yes. Yeah, it's his job, you know. Sun god means his job is supply and control and withdraw the power of seeing. So it's in that sense. In that sense. Yeah. One is controlled and one is a controller. See, the thing is that before they get their bodies, then they're only identifiable as jivas, because their capacities as controller and controlled are not visible yet, because the body in which the capacity manifests is not there in both cases. Yeah, it's like that. One is an adibhotic condition which has the capacity to control, and the other is the adibhotic, you know, which doesn't have that. It only has the capacity to be controlled. But even the superior adibhotic, the demigod, is also controlled by the supersoul. Yeah. He got that body by the arrangement of the supersoul. He got that control by the arrangement of the supersoul. Is he doing it because, are you saying? Well, you know, I think we'd have to ask him, really. But I don't think you could really say that. You know, that may be some element there in his mind. But it is a fact. There is oneness. There's a limited oneness. So as far as that limited oneness goes, then we can say, okay, the jiva is like the supersoul. Yeah, you know, Jiva Goswami, in the beginning of Tattvasandarbha, in his commentary, well, in the beginning of Tattvasandarbha, he's talking about what reference materials he will draw from. Bhagavatam, certain commentaries, particularly Sridharaswami, also Madhvacharya, Ramanuja, will draw from these. Then he says in his commentary, we'll also draw from the writings of Shankaracharya as far as they're relevant. Actually, he says, we'll draw from the writings of Ramanuja as far as they're relevant. Yeah. So Ramanuja, you know, is relevant further than Shankaracharya, but not completely. Otherwise, we just take what Ramanuja says. But at a certain point, even with Ramanuja, we say, no, sorry, it's not really like that. It's something else. It's a little different. And, you know, with Shankara, we can also say, he says, Aham Brahmasmi. We say, yes, of course. But, you know, pretty quickly we come to the point where we say, sorry. Yeah. Any other comment or question? Yes? I don't know if that's really the right question. You know, do you mean the human beings? Because the demigods are conditioned souls also. So, you know, if you become purified materially sufficiently, you can become a demigod. If a person practices the regulative principles of a Brahmin perfectly for 100 lifetimes, they can become Lord Brahma. Yeah. The regulative principles of a Brahmin perfectly for 100 lifetimes, they can become Lord Brahma. Yeah. So, but if you mean us, that we could observe the demigods, you know, there goes Lord Indra or something like that. You know, I don't think it, well, you know, very great, great devotees, they may have some consciousness like that. Like Prabhupada, there were times, there's one famous incident which had just happened just before I joined. So it was the talk, it was like the talk when I joined. You know, what Prabhupada had just said and done. There was a program somewhere, and unfortunately the devotees arranged the program like over the road from, in some hall, across the road from another hall, where at exactly the same time there was some big rock concert or something like that. And everyone went to the rock concert, and no one came to Prabhupada's program. Or maybe, you know, a couple of people. But Prabhupada still carried on and did the program. And afterwards, the devotees apologized to Prabhupada that we should have arranged it in another way, you know. Because nobody came. We're so sorry. Prabhupada said, what do you mean no one came? Didn't you see Lord Brahma? Didn't you see Narada Muni? So that was the talk when I joined it. It just happened. Yeah. So it may be. One of our devotees told me he was with Srila Prabhupada flying across the Swiss Alps. And Prabhupada looked out the window and nonchalantly told the devotee, here, there is one mountain. It is 100,000 miles high. And the devotee looked at him like, I beg your pardon. And Prabhupada saw, you know, this sort of like, you know, perhaps slight doubting and maybe slightly cynical type of attitude. And Prabhupada immediately sort of like just became very hard. And he said, yes, I have seen it. So it may be like that. It may be like that. Any other comment or question? Okay, so now we've reached our weekend and we've reached the end of the discussion in Tattva Sandarbha, which is on the basis of Shukadev Goswami's understanding or presentation of the 10 topics. So next week, meaning on Friday, then we'll start from text 61, where we discuss how Suta Goswami presents the 10 topics. So, if you have time over the weekend, read through 61. Think about it a bit. It's pretty long. So go through 61 if you have time, and you'll be ready for our discussion on Friday. Srila Prabhupada ki. Upadi means like an artificial imposition which becomes a designation. Yeah, like the body is the main upadi. It's an imposition on us because we are pure spirit souls. Yeah, but it's we accept it as a designation. So it's like that.
Here it says, this physical body is said to be a person because it is an upadi superimposed upon the real.
Yes, it's referred to as a person. Of course it's not a person, but we refer to it as a person, meaning the adibhautik purusha, the purusha, in those terms. Yeah, because it seems like a person.
Yeah, when the jiva is
yes,
there.
It seems like a person. We think, oh yes, there he is, there she is. That means the adibhautik person, the body. Yeah, so there's like personness has become attributed. Yeah.
Okay. So you mean meaning that it is an artificial thing, like
yes,
a
it's,
superficial thing.
Yeah.
It's not the real.
That's self. Right. So we say, you know, we under the circumstances we refer to it as a person. Like for example, I don't know if you're familiar with law, but then law.
Yeah.
Then,
law.
Then you know they're natural persons and legal persons.
Yes.
So it's just like that.
Oh.
It's like a company, you know, is a legal person and can be sued and can sue. Yeah, so it's like that. But it's not a person, but just under the circumstances.
Yeah, it's like a made-up thing. Like
that's right.
A legal person, like a company, it's all made up.
Yeah, it's made up. So this body is made up.
Yeah.
It is. It's just a nonsense, actually. But under the circumstances, we say, all right, we'll refer to it as a person.